Robin Hood Radio welcomes you to David Freeman's Science Insider with your host, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, David Freeman.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. Today we're talking aliens, and we have the perfect guest for that. And no, it's not someone who was kidnapped and abducted by aliens and taken off into a flying saucer to be probed in embarrassing ways. It's the senior astronomer at the SETI Institute. SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And I'm talking about Seth Shostak. So welcome to the show, Seth.
Thank you very much, David. It's a pleasure.
So I know that a couple years ago, I believe it was, you bet an audience you were speaking to that we would find extraterrestrial life, we'd make contact within the next, I think, 24 years, and if not, you'd buy them all coffee. And then I think I saw another place in which you said that we would find extraterrestrial life by the end of the century. So when are we going to find it, and how confident are you that we're going to find it?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that latter guess, because that's what these are. I mean, I could use euphemisms and say that they are reasonable estimates. But of course, in the end, they are guesses, because we haven't found any life beyond Earth yet. Not yet. Not even bacteria. Not even dead bacteria. But what's happening in terms of the search for some biology beyond our planet is the fact that we're developing new technologies that would allow us to find it if it's out there. And it's my take on all this that one of these approaches is going to pay off in the next, say, 24 years. And it may only be to find, evidence for microbes on Mars that may have lived 4 billion years ago. It may be finding oxygen in the atmosphere of some planet 50 light years away. Or it may be picking up a signal from some clever extraterrestrials with our radio telescopes. But I think that the technologies are getting so good that by mid-century, we will indeed have succeeded on one of these fronts. I don't know about the end of the century. I'm not sure what article that was. I don't remember saying that. But
well, so let's talk a little bit about the technologies. How exactly are we looking for extraterrestrial life?
Yeah, there's kind of a three-pronged approach here. And one prong is to simply go there and look. Of course, this is what they do on Star Trek, right? I mean, they just put the pedal to the metal and they rocket off to some other world. Well, we can't do that except in our own solar system. So NASA, the European Space Agency, some other countries are sending, robotic hardware to Mars, but also to the outer solar system. There's something like a half dozen, maybe more now, worlds right next door to us, moons of Jupiter, moons of Saturn, Mars, obviously, where it could be that there is some biology or was some biology. And those are worlds we can get to with our rockets. So that's one way to find them. And in the next 24 years, we may indeed succeed at that because these technologies are getting better. The second prong, if you will, is to build a big space-based telescope and just sort of sniff the atmosphere of a planet around another star. You do that by making a spectrum of the light being reflected from the atmosphere of that planet. And if you can do that, and all it takes is a big telescope to do that, you might see there's oxygen, for example, in that atmosphere, an inordinate amount of oxygen. And you would say, well, I don't know. I don't know what's going on there, but oxygen is usually a sign of photosynthesis. So that would be a second way to find life. And the third way is to do what Jodie Foster did in the movie Contact, and we do that here at this SETI Institute, where we have a bunch of antennas and we train them on some nearby star systems, hoping to eavesdrop on ET.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the movie. How accurate was that in terms of looking at radio frequencies and seeing with scanning the universe? Is that pretty much how the work is done there?
Well, of course, Contact was based on Carl Sagan's 1983 novel of the same name, and Sagan knew very well how SETI worked. He was actually a board member of the SETI Institute here where I am. So it is technically accurate insofar as it deals with SETI. I was actually a consultant for the film. Several of us here at the Institute were. And they would call me up just about every other day, it seemed, with interesting questions like, all right, Seth, what does it look like when you fly through a wormhole? And mind you, I haven't flown through a wormhole too recently, but, so those were the kinds of questions we were getting. But in terms of the astronomy and the technology, that's all pretty accurate. I mean, the middle of the film, Jodie Foster gets this big machine built and tries to travel to the stars. That's something else. That's all fiction, of course.
Right.
But but in terms of the SETI, it was quite accurate.
But what sort of signal do you expect to find? If you're obviously, if there's some kind of bacterial or plant life, you're not likely to receive some sort of intelligent signal. But what, when in your dreams, what sort of signal do you hope to find?
Well, I think that it's safe to say that nobody out there, assuming that there's not only life in space, but some of it is at least intelligent, and by that we mean they're, you know, technically sophisticated. They're not going to know about us. They're not going to know about Homo sapiens, because how could they know? The only way they could know is if they were close enough to see, you know, I don't know, the Roman aqueducts or something like that. And they say, well, you know, but they're not that close. They couldn't possibly see that. But what they could do is pick up our radars, beginning with the Second World War, our television, FM radio. These are all signals that do go out into space in a big way. And if they have sensitive enough antennas, they could pick that up. However, we've only been doing that since the Second World War, so those signals are not very far out into space. I think it's safe to say that nobody knows we're here. I don't know if you consider that a comfort or a disappointment,
But what kind of signal? Let's say that some intelligent alien life did pick up the signals emanating from Earth. In what form would a signal and response likely, what would that response be like? What would you see on your computer screen?
Well, if we picked up a signal, I mean, there are various things you could look for. You could look for the message, the so-called modulation in the signal. For example, a television signal. It consists of various components. There's the audio over here and the video over there and the color information over there and so forth and so on. I mean, ET might be able to take that apart if they're pretty good engineers. But the easy thing to do, and what we do with our experiments, is not to worry so much about the message, just try and prove that the signal is really there. So what you do is you essentially look for a radio signal, you know, on your receiver that's at one spot on the dial. In other words, it's what's called narrow band. In other words, it's not a signal that no matter where you tune, you find it. That would be true if you were listening to the radio noise coming from the sun, for example. It's all over the band. But if you find something that's in just one spot on your dial, then you say, you know, Bob, I don't know what that is, but that's the kind of signal only transmitters make. So at least I can say they're on the air.
But so let's say you did receive a signal like that and you were convinced that it was from some intelligent life form off the planet. The distances are so vast, it would have meant that this would have been traveled for a long, long, long time, and it would take a long time to contact them back, correct? How could you have a conversation in any way?
Well, you'd have to be very patient. I think that's right. You would need the patience of Job, I think, to do that, because, in fact, I mean, it depends, of course, on how far away they are. The nearest other star system to ours is, you know, 4.5 light years away, more or less. And so that signal would be 4.5 years old. And if you responded, it would take 4.5 years for your response to get back there, and so forth. So, you know, the back and forth time is 9 years or whatever. That's tolerable. You could have a couple of exchanges. But, you know, ET is unlikely to be so close. It's not going to be on the next star out. That would be remarkable if true. So maybe they're a couple of hundred light years away, or maybe even 1,000 light years away, which means that conversation is really going to be tedious at best, and I think thoroughly impractical.
Yes.
But I think that says something. I mean, you know, the extraterrestrials, the aliens, they'll know that. And so if they're deliberately broadcasting something for our delectation, you know, just to impress us somehow, I think they'll just send as much information as they can, because they'll know it's one-way communication.
Right, but hence the idea, I think, for Contact, which was to build a machine that was going to rocket people off to through a wormhole to their civilization. But what about, do you have any concern, and I think Stephen Hawking has said this, that there's some concern that these extraterrestrials, if they do exist, intelligent extraterrestrials do exist, and I think everyone agrees that they do, somewhere, they may be carnivorous, and there may be some danger in reaching out to these aliens. Do you share that feeling?
I don't. I don't share that fear. Now, mind you, this can easily degenerate into a discussion about what is the likely, you know, mindset of the aliens. And the answer to that is, we don't know the answer to that. Of course we don't. Right.
Right.
So, And it might be very naive to say, well, if they're so advanced, they could pick up our signals. They'll all be, you know, peaceful and you know, Zen-like and contemplating their navels or whatever. I mean, that's a possibility. But, you know, if only 1% of them are not like that, 1% of them are like Attila the Hun, then you might say, well, there's some legitimacy in worrying about, you know, getting in touch. However, my take on this is the following. You know, you can worry about it or you don't have to worry about it, whatever. The facts are that ever since the Second World War, we have been sending signals into space. And while most of those are pretty weak, not all of them are weak. In particular, the radars are not very weak. And any society that could, you know, do you harm, any society that has the technology to come here or whatever and be carnivorous, if that's what's on their mind, they can pick up those signals when these signals reach them. So in a sense, we've been broadcasting our presence for the last 70 years. We continue to do that. And I'm sure in the next, you know, couple of centuries, we'll build even bigger stuff that'll betray our presence too. So either you say, I'm going to get into my hidey hole and be quiet for the rest of Homo sapiens' existence, which doesn't strike me as a very good idea, or you have to say, you know, I just can't worry about the fact that I make a little noise.
Right. So there are a couple of other ways that, you know, to find life that we were talking about. You talked about a bit earlier, other than listening to the radio signals here on Earth. One is to build space telescopes, and of course, Kepler is a satellite that I guess is doing just that. Correct?
Yeah, Kepler is indeed its job, or at least its job was before it, you know, lost some of its stabilization stuff. Was to find planets. Its actual mandate was to try and find planets more or less the same size as Earth at the right distance from their home star so that they could be habitable. In other words, that you could have liquid water on their surfaces. That's what Kepler has been trying to do. In the meantime, it has found literally thousands of planets.
Right. It seems like every week there's a new planet, a new clutch of planets being found.
That's right. It's kind of raining planets. Now, mind you, very few of these so far have been very much like the Earth, or at least potentially like the Earth. They've been too close in, or they've been too big, or whatever. And that actually has more to do with the way planets are detected than it does with the actual inventory, if you will, of planets. As the instruments get better, we find more and more small planets. The Earth is a small planet. And more planets that might be indeed habitable, as it is called. And we have something like 20 of those already.
And so this idea of habitable exoplanets, that's extrapolating from Earth. Is it pretty clear that the life is likely to be found, extraterrestrial life is likely to be found, if it is, on a planet that is rocky and with liquid water, as you said? Isn't it possible there's some other form of life we can't envision?
Yeah, well, one should never say never. And the facts are that there may be forms of life that we just, you know, haven't thought about at all that allow it to exist in environments where, you would say it's going to be dead, Jim. certainly that's possible. And I hear that a lot. People write me emails several times a week saying, you guys are so conservative. You're just looking for life as we know it. Well, that's true. That is true. And it is conservative. But on the other hand, if you're spending real money to do this, you know, you got to start from somewhere. Because if you just say blue sky it, I'm going to go look for, I'm going to look for life on Mercury or Pluto or something like that. You can say, well, there's not going to be much in the way of liquids there. And you know, it's hard to get chemistry going if you don't have liquids and so forth and so on. I mean, you can say, I don't know what I don't know, but that doesn't help you design an experiment. So in general, we tend to consider something habitable if it's the kind of world where terrestrial life could exist, because at least, you know, that allows you to say something.
Right. So at the beginning in the introduction, I kind of tongue-in-cheek introduction talked about the idea of alien abductions. And I'm sure you've heard from a lot of people who claim to have been abducted. Is that the case?
Every day.
So are there any, you're also famous, I think, for debunking these. Are there any cases in which you think, well, wait a minute, maybe this guy's telling the truth?
Well, I think that they're all telling the truth in this sense. I mean, I hear from people, as I say, on a daily basis, who, not every day that they've been abducted, but, you know, every day that they've seen something that they interpret as being, you know, alien spacecraft. I get at least two calls a week from people who will say very mysteriously, I have something very important to tell you. And I know what that means. What it means is that they've seen something funny on their computer screen or something in the sky and whatever. Now, all these people, as far as I can tell, they're all legit. They're all you know, they're not making up stories. They're not trying to hoodwink me. They're not, you know, this is not some sort of scam. They have seen something, they have experienced something, and they think it's connected with extraterrestrials. So they're very genuine. But if you listen to the evidence or you look at the videos or the photos or whatever it is they supply, then you say, you know, maybe this is a spacecraft with ETs inside. It's possible. On the other hand, it could be in an aircraft, or it could be Jupiter, you know, on a with a handheld video camera just bouncing around the frame. There are always, I've never seen anything where I said, you know, that's pretty unequivocal. That's for real. Never.
And certainly nothing. In no case, and you're talking about people citing things, but there's certainly, have you ever come across a case in which someone actually claimed to have been aboard a spacecraft that really made you think anything other than this is a nut?
Well, it's not that they're nuts. I don't know that they're nuts. I mean, in
well,
some
they're
cases,
deluded, let's say. They're deluded somehow.
Well, it's true that in some cases people will admit that they have other problems, psychological problems. There's that. But yeah, being aboard a spacecraft is a fairly rare thing, but being abducted is not so rare. In fact, there was a poll taken like 10 or 15 years ago that was interpreted by at least one polling organization to indicate that something like 8% of Americans think they may have been abducted by aliens. Now, there are people who actually study this, and they're mostly psychologists. Yeah, I think that was overly optimistic. But some psychologists have studied this, and they have come up with various, things that happen to people that they think account for these reports, in particular something called sleep paralysis. You know, when you sort of wake up and just before your body is allowed to move around, you know, you feel paralyzed and you often think somebody's standing around the bed looking at you and so forth and so on. So that seems to be an explanation for a lot of these things. But here's the deal. If somebody is really doing this, even aside from why they'd want to do this, you know, come stand around your bed as you sleep. But if somebody is really experiencing this, everybody has a camera now, right? They got their cell phones and so forth. The cameras all over the place to take a picture, or when they take you onto the spacecraft, just grab a Klingon ballpoint pen off the dashboard or something. Just some real physical evidence would clinch the case. It just doesn't happen.
Right. Well, speaking of that, so let's imagine that you find a signal this afternoon or tomorrow. You're responsible for reporting it to the world. Do you worry that you're going to be not taken seriously?
Well, I might not be. I'm sure I wouldn't be taken seriously everywhere. There are some people who are going to do, you know, I mean, people who are very fundamentalists, for example, in their religious beliefs may say, you know, there's nothing about this in the Bible, and consequently, this is not true. It's been hypothesized that there will be that kind of reaction. Then there'll be other people who won't believe it for whatever reason. But here's the difference between this and, say, you know, tomorrow's UFO sighting. It's that the UFO sighting is very hard to verify. I mean, somebody sees something, or maybe they get a, you know, a shaky video or something, but you can't repeat the experiment. You can't say, all right, I'm going to go back tonight and look for it and hope to see it, because, you know, you won't see it, and they'll just say, well, it's gone.
Right.
But if we were to pick up a signal this afternoon, we wouldn't announce that right away, because we would say, you know, it's probably just more interference. We would just keep following it and checking it. And then if it still looked like, you know, this is the real deal, then we would call up somebody at another observatory, somebody else with the kind of equipment it takes, and say, look in this spot on the sky, give them the coordinates and the frequency, and say, see if you can find it. So that's the difference. If we make the claim that we found something, you know, there'll be 100 different research groups spread around the world that can all go out and either prove that we're right or prove that we're wrong. And that's science.
So, and you probably have done this thought experiment before. You alluded to this a little bit, but have you thought about what would happen if we found got a signal from a clearly intelligent alien life form? What would happen to our society?
Yeah, well, there is certainly historic precedent for what would happen. I mean, a lot of people tell me, oh, well, you know, the federal government would keep it all quiet. They always assume the Americans will find the signal, by the way, and maybe we will, maybe we won't. But in any case, they figure the American government is particularly nefarious, and they'll keep it quiet because otherwise the public would go crazy. And, you know, personally, I don't believe that, because we've had that experiment. 100 years ago, people were talking about the canals on Mars, and reputable people were saying there were canals on Mars. This very intelligent group of people, or Martians, I should say, up there, you know, busily trenching their planet with shovel-ready projects. The public didn't go crazy. They just thought, oh, well, that's kind of interesting.
They loved it. They ate it up, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So if if we were to pick up a signal and we, you know, after a couple of days of looking at it, decide, you know, this looks real, and we would announce it as, you know, we found this thing and it looks real, and every telescope in the world would immediately start looking in this direction. I don't think that the public is going to go crazy and say, well, you know, that's it. I'm not going on vacation this summer. I'm not going to work tomorrow or whatever. They would just say, that's interesting. Tell us more. Let's learn more. What can we say about these guys? So I think that would be the reaction.
But in terms of, I guess people would still want to go on vacation, but are there, you know, I think, you know, particularly about, say, organized religion, is it going to, or Judeo-Christian religion, is it going to, it'll upset everything, right? Is everything's going to be, you know, rewritten, I guess?
Well, that doesn't seem to be the case, insofar as we know, and not a whole lot of research has been done into this, actually. There's a fellow by the name of Mike Ashkenazi who actually looked into this to the extent of quizzing theologians of the three atomist religions, so that's Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and asked them, you know, suppose we found that there was intelligent life on a planet, you know, 100 light years away or something, you know, how would that affect things? And they say, oh, no problem, we can handle that. You know, this is not 1600. People are expecting this to be true. So the claim is that, in fact, most organized religions would have very little difficulty accommodating this. Now, the exception, apparently, according to people, some sociologists who study this, are, again, fundamentalists who say, no, right. Wait a minute, this can't be. So that would be a problem, perhaps, for some groups.
Right. So let me ask you this, and you're going back to the movie and the book Contact. There's, I guess, the Jodie Foster character, who I guess is a former colleague, is based on a former colleague of yours. Is that right, Jill Tarter?
Well, Jill Tarter is certainly one candidate and a favorite one, actually, among many people. And if you ask Jill, she's very careful to say that, well, you know, a lot of things do accord with my own personal history. And of course, I knew Carl Sagan and so forth and so on. So, but I've also talked to other female astronomers who claim that Jodie Foster's character, Ellie Arroway, is based on them. So,
right.
You know, and I suspect, but don't know, I suspect that what Sagan did was make an amalgam of several of these people. But indeed, Jill Tarter here, who has led our SETI experiment for many years, she did that for many years, is certainly one of the prototypes, yes.
And that character is, I guess, shown as someone who is absolutely passionate about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and against all odds wants to keep going and looking. You've been looking for ET for a long time, and I wonder, do you ever have a feeling like, what the heck am I doing here?
Well, I think no matter what job you have, you're going to have that feeling sometimes, but really not. I certainly don't get discouraged by the lack of finding a signal so far because, you know, it says nothing about whether ET is out there. We've just barely scratched the surface in terms of the search space. That is to say, how many star systems have we actually looked at carefully with our antennas hoping to pick up a signal? And that's a very small number. It's a few thousand, something on that order. Well, you know, the galaxy has several hundred billion star systems. So looking at a few thousand is such a tiny sample that the fact that you haven't succeeded so far is like saying to Chris Columbus, you know, after 3 days of sailing away from Cadiz, hey, you haven't found any new continents, you know, come on back and let's play cards. I mean, right?
Yeah, but 3 days is a bit different from decades or centuries.
But not in terms of the experiment, because if you're going to find ET with this scheme, nobody knows how many star systems you have to look at. But if you just sort of take, you know, middle-of-the-road estimates of how many societies might be out there in our Milky Way, it turns out that you've got to look at maybe 1 million or 2 million or 10 million star systems to have a reasonable chance of success. And we're nowhere near that number. But the experiments keep getting faster. And in fact, over the course of the next 24 years, I think if we can continue to get funding to do this, we will have looked at a million or 2 million star systems. And that's why I bet people a cup of coffee that we'll find ET with some time like that.
Well, you mentioned funding, and I guess you have a bunch of different funding sources. Do you ever look jealously at some of the other scientific projects that get funded, that get criticized? I mean, I think of something like CERN, which, of course, a lot of people love, but a lot of people say, well, so we discovered the Higgs boson. What does that mean?
Yeah, and that's an experiment whose cost is measured in the literally, you know, billions, really tens of billions of dollars. That's very expensive. But on the other hand, it's basic physics. And one thing we've learned ever since the Second World War is that basic physics always pays off. you always get something out of that in the civilian economy, whereas astronomy, you know, is very interesting to people. But on the other hand, you know, what has it done for me lately? Well, it's actually done a lot for you, but people don't make that connection.
Right.
But the funding for SETI is incredibly tiny. There's no government money for it, not in the United States. It's all donations. So that means that the total number of people in the United States who are doing SETI as their career choice, David, you know, it's fewer than 10.
Mm. Wow. So before we go, we have a few minutes left. I want to ask you about Voyager, which was the spacecraft sent out, NASA sent out. I forget, was it 76? What was the year it went out?
Yeah,
it was
something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, A couple of them.
Yes, the late 70s.
Right, the late 70s. So that was the spacecraft that's been in the news a lot in the last year or so, with people saying it had left the heliopause, it left our solar system. Well, maybe not. Yes, it has. But what interests me about that, of course, is the I believe a plaque on the side. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What you make of that?
Yes, in fact. It has actually records, but the Pioneer spacecraft that were launched a little bit earlier do have this plaque with a sort of a nudie cutie graphic on it, you know, and a sort of a greeting to anybody who picks it up. Now, and the Voyagers have a record that you can play. It actually has a diagram showing you where to put the needle, if anybody can remember what needles are. So, you know, that's...
Yeah, that's funny. I have to figure out a way to play that.
Yeah, I think you have to look at these things not as serious attempts to communicate with the extraterrestrials, because those guys, those spacecraft, they're moving out into space at about 7, 8, 9 miles per second, which would be great if you were going to New Jersey. But, you know, it'll take them a million years before they're in the vicinity, which is to say within a light year of some other star, because they're just going off in random directions. And it would take them at that speed, it would take them almost 100,000 years just to get to the nearest star. So in that time, you know, the plaque and the record may all be sort of obliterated by micrometeorites, who knows? But you know, these things are the size of a VW Beetle. And even for Klingons, to find something a light year away the size of a VW Beetle in space strikes me as unlikely. These are mostly about us, not about the aliens.
Well, yeah. So were those spacecraft essentially stunts to have records and plaques? Was that kind of a joke that NASA perpetrated on everyone, or was it serious?
No, I think it was serious in this sense. I mean, the spacecraft were launched not to carry messages to aliens. The spacecraft were launched to study the bodies of the outer solar system, the planets and the moons of the outer solar system, which turned out to have enormously interesting personalities. So it was fabulously interesting and wealthy in terms of the science return. That was what they're for. But somebody at NASA, a guy by the name of Eric Burgess, actually, recognized that the Pioneers were going to be the first spacecraft we ever launched, the first bit of hardware made by humans to actually leave the solar system. And he thought, you know, as long as you're sending it anyhow, why not put a builder's plate on it? Why not put this little plaque on the license plate? So, you know, just to show that, hey, made by Earthlings. And so that's how it got started.
So one last question. What about Curiosity, the rover that's on Mars now, that's looking around, snooping around, and there's a lot of talk of finding water and so on. How likely is it that, do you think, that Curiosity is going to find evidence of life?
Well, Curiosity, lamentably, is not really designed to find life. NASA, you know, in the 1970s, actually landed what were called the Viking landers, two of them, on Mars, looking for life. And the results came back as ambiguous at best. Most people connected with the project concluded there's no life. They couldn't find it with that equipment. But on the other hand, there's been, you know, controversy about that and so forth and so on. And it was very expensive and very difficult. And so NASA decided, look, you know, next time what we're going to do is do this very methodically. First, we'll look for the evidence on Mars where there might have been liquid water on the surface long time ago. It's not there now, but might have been a long time ago. And then we'll look for life there. Okay, so in other words, try and do this step by step so that they get a result that actually means something rather than something that turned out to be ambiguous. And so Curiosity is designed to, you know, again, to investigate what's called the hydrologic history of Mars, you know, where the water was and that sort of thing. And that's why they're always discovering new signs of water on Mars, because that's the first step. And if you can say, hey, look, you know, 4 billion years ago, this place here was a lake and that lake was here for millions of years, then, okay, let's dig around, see if we can see any fossil remnants in that soil there.
Right. All right, well, unfortunately, we're out of time because I'd love to keep asking you a bunch of questions, but That's all the time we have now. I've been speaking with Seth Shostak, who is the principal astronomer at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, and it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much, Seth.
My pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
Science Insider with David Freeman, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, produced in cooperation with Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com, on the web.